The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod. Sentencing day. Sam Bankman-Fried faces years in prison following the massive fraud conspiracy and collapse of crypto platform FTX. Puck's Teddy Schleifer on the story.
When you think about the big picture here, about what is the role of a judge, a prison, you know, you have to consider things like, is this person going to be safe? You know, should we care about his kind of mental condition over the next 40, 50 years of his life?
TikTok in the voting booth. How much Gen Z really cares about TikToking, and will it impact the presidential election? With CNBC contributor Joanne Littman.
This is where they go for their news. All the news they're getting about this legislation comes from TikTok.
And the app's role in our democracy, NYU professor Josh Tucker.
We don't know what's going on with TikTok because TikTok hasn't made their data available for external researchers. We're kind of going into this blind.
Plus, Home Depot making a bet on contractors and the Fed governor offering breadcrumbs on rate cuts. It's Thursday, March 28th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue it, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan. Andrew is off today. Today is Thursday, but it is the last trading day of the week and the last trading day of the quarter. Folks, we do have some breaking news on a Dow component, Home Depot. The company is acquiring SRS Distribution for $18.25 billion. SRS is a leading building products distributor that supplies professional roofers, landscapers, and pool contractors. Home Depot says that that acquisition will accelerate its growth within the residential professional customer. It's been a really big deal. HD Pro, that's where they've seen a lot of the growth. Home Depot says it expects to complete the deal by the end of this year. I just got off the phone with the CEO and the CFO talking a little bit about this. I was not familiar with SRS. No. It was founded in 2008, and it's grown every year. In fact, the Home Depot CEO, Ted Decker, says it was up last year during our period of moderation. You did see Home Depot sales or Home Depot's earnings slow after the phenomenal growth they saw during the pandemic. SRS is based in the greater Dallas area. The entire management team is sticking around. They've got 760 branches in 47 states, a sales force of 2,500 people, and 4,000 trucks that deliver directly to the job sites. I don't know. I got to look at the rest of this. It looks that it's going to meet one of Home Depot's three big goals this year. They said this is one of the big opportunities Decker did because the pro is where you see all of the growth happening. That's what they've been trying to expand on. Just in terms of the total addressable market, right now, Home Depot has a total addressable market of about $950 billion in what is, I believe, a $45 trillion market. If you just look at home values overall, they think that this acquisition will raise their TAM to $1 trillion, that they'll then have a much bigger addressable market. Looking to close by the end of the year. They say it will be gap dilutive in the first year because of amortization of the deal, but cash accretive in year one. I think the big issue here, though, is going to be what regulators say and whether they sign off on this. Decker saying they don't anticipate any regulatory issues because it is a separate customer base, but there is a breakup fee. They wouldn't tell me how big the breakup fee is. It's going to be in the SEC filings later today. But we all know the regulatory environment that you're looking at. SRS is number two in pools, for instance. Home Depot, obviously, the biggie. And we'll see what kind of scrutiny this gets.
$382 billion. Years ago, we would have thought, wow, that's a lot for Home Depot, but they can. Seems like they could easily do an acquisition like this. While you were talking, I was saying, so there's a big market in. There's regular Home Depot, and then there's the pros. The pro, that's what this is.
Yeah, the contractors.
Is there something for people that have no ability whatsoever to use Home Depot products? Like there's
yeah,
a pro.
Light bulbs.
No, I need, here's like the normal person that I see there, and then these are really professionals doing
professionals
roofing,
do a ton of
construction.
Yeah, contractors do a ton
home
of
home building.
Yeah. They use
this is
Home
a
Depot
huge
pretty.
Market.
the people who are going for light bulbs use?
People that hurt their thumbs, people that, yeah.
Need seed for the yard?
That when I hear someone's putting in a bathroom.
Oh, by themselves? Like,
yeah. People do that.
Yes, they do.
They put in cabinetry.
They do.
And some people find that an attractive feature for a man to have.
Got lucky with Penelope.
But
look, it's a big deal. Yesterday, I was just looking through some of the analyst notes. Yesterday, D.A. Davidson cut its rating on Lowe's, Home Depot's biggest competitor. And they said even though he loves Marvin Ellison and the leadership there, they're going to have a real tough time, he
all
thinks,
about growth, right?
In terms of growth. And his suggestion in that note was for Lowe's to do something with the contractor. That has been a really strong
Lowe's
point for Home
even
Depot.
Further from
this
that.
Is going to make Home Depot even bigger.
Yeah,
in the
Lowe's seems
business.
Even further from that niche that Home Depot can occupy so well. Home Depot, we saw the stock had been down. It's come back with a vengeance, so. TikTok has launched a $2.1 million advertising campaign with a clear message for senators in tough re-election fights this year. Block that House divestor ban TikTok bill. The ad urges senators to think about, in their words, think about the 5 million small business owners that rely on TikTok to provide for their families.
The village is always there for the moms on TikTok.
To see all of that disappear would be so sad.
It's going to affect a lot of people's livelihoods.
We have got to make enough noise about this so that they don't take away our voice.
TikTok has reserved TV ad space in battleground states, including Nevada, Montana, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. And data from Ad Impact also shows TikTok bought ad time in New York, Massachusetts, and Minnesota. I don't know if any of those are battlegrounds. The ad started running yesterday.
It's very disingenuous to say, think of this all disappeared. Okay, what if it was sold to American hands, which the Chinese would never allow? They would be the ones who would shut it down.
Right.
So
I'm not going to make any comments here. There's a lot of things that go on TikTok, I think, that don't look like what they were just.
No,
but I'm not
I will say there's a good side of social media. There really is. It helps communities come together, people who can't find each other. But there are a lot of bad things, too. The bigger issue is this is about neither of those things. This is about what is happening with your personal information and data.
Right.
That's the question.
Right, because we'd have to go after everybody, basically.
Right. Every single one of the social media companies have a good and bad side on them.
Right.
Good evening and welcome to the 751st meeting of the Economic Club of New York. For today's program, I'm honored to welcome Chris Waller. Chris took office as a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System in 2020.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My subject, as it often is the outlook for the U.S. economy and how that affects the Federal Open Market Committee's, or FOMC's, continuing effort to reduce inflation to a sustained level of 2% while maintaining a healthy labor market. We needed time to verify that the progress on inflation we saw in the second half of 2023 would continue, which meant there was no rush to begin cutting interest rates to normalize the stance of monetary policy.
These comments coming from Waller really making people think.
And he wasn't saying that the economy looks weaker than expected or stronger than expected. He was saying that inflation.
And the inflation numbers have been very worrying. The data that we've gotten recently, and that's why he is taking down his expectations in terms of how many.
He's not sure we're restrictive at this point, and that they're going to have to be really sure before they cut. And that if you cut when you haven't gotten it under control, then it can come back.
That's a problem. And then you're going to have to flip and really raise rates again.
Chris Waller, the Fed governor, he says there's no rush to lower interest rates. Steve Leisman joins us now with more. This is like part two. Waller said something similar. Was it a month ago, Steve? Has it been a month already?
Yeah, it's been a while, but he's really the most definitive here, Joe. The governor suggesting that the Federal Reserve would cut fewer times this year and start later as a result of the stronger than expected growth data we've had and inflation data so far this year. Here's a summary of what he said. No rush to cut, as Joe said. It's prudent to hold, he said, at a restrictive level, quote, longer than previously thought, and it's appropriate to reduce the number of cuts or push them into the future. And he's not ready to cut until inflation progress materializes. More on that in a second. The Fed governor went on to say that the risk of waiting a little longer to cut rates is significantly lower than acting too soon.
In the absence of an unexpected and material deterioration in the real economy, I'm going to need to see at least a couple of months of better inflation data before I have enough confidence that beginning to cut rates will keep the economy on a path to 2% inflation.
So we did say a couple months. So Fed rate cut probabilities fell, with June still trading at around 60%. Of course, it goes up as the year goes by. So he didn't rule out that June cut if the next several inflation reports show some decent progress. But he definitely raised the bar and said that it looked to him as if inflation progress so far had slowed and may have stalled. Almost every Fed official who has spoken in the wake of the recent meeting has supported a slower or more cautious approach to rate cuts, with Waller being the most explicit here. The question is whether Fed Chair Powell misspoke or was maybe misunderstood at his recent press conference. Markets seemed to walk away thinking he was dovish. His committee members so far have been more hawkish than he has been. And just one other thing to point out, Joe, the market taking it pretty well, I've got to say. Right, you hit a record high yesterday. You came off last night in the futures market with these remarks. But I'm guessing that Waller really just gave voice to what the market had already sort of figured out here.
I read specifically into where he's worried about inflation. There was some import price inflation that he mentioned, Steve. And what else? What else? Where are the pockets of where you would say sticky inflation? Where is that still? Where do we need to worry?
I mean, there's two dynamics going on, Joe. First, that you have that sticky service inflation. We've talked a lot about that.
Yeah.
Those housing numbers have not come down yet. And then even ex-housing service sector has been kind of lousy. But you've also had this kind of little bit of a surge in commodity prices recently. Cocoa, copper, and other things like it have gone up. You've got some issues around the world when it comes to the Red Sea. I don't know about this Baltimore situation. Waller did say that the Baltimore accident is not going to have a big effect. The Fed's view so far is it won't have a big effect on the economy or on inflation. But you have seen what was a negative number for goods prices and was offsetting the sticky service inflation. It's gotten a little less negative, right. And that's something we have to watch.
Well, is this true? He sees core goods disinflation stalling out due to elevated import price increases.
Yeah. And Joe, you kind of forced me to talk a little bit about something I'm working on, not ready yet, but we do seem to have better global growth. One of the things that we've benefited from recently has been some of the weaker economies, and we've been importing a little disinflation. And I've been trying to figure out how much of the stickiness of the inflation has been coming from abroad. China did a stimulus. Japan looks to be doing a little better. Some of the numbers out of Europe have not been as bad as we have previously seen. So it may be that we had a little gift last year from weaker global economies, and that impulse could be turning around now.
Wow, we dodged a bullet here, Becky. I'm going to read this right now. Thanks,
Steve. But that's going to be good for U.S. growth, too, Joe.
Right. There's numbers coming out.
I know, the PCE, which, by the way, are they on for that?
Yeah. Can we ixnay on the even Ockingte about it? Or we're going to be...
Come later.
Huh?
Come later.
What does?
PCE.
Tomorrow. Oh, I guess Morgan and Steve and Rick...
Because it
will
comes
be
a little
online.
Later in the morning.
It does. It says 8:15.
Oh, is it 8:15?
Oh, full coverage begins. Oh, it's in the copy. What a concept. Let me read it then. And a programming note. Tomorrow the markets are closed, but the government is open. Yay. That means key inflation data will still be released at 8:30 a.m. So 8:30 a.m. Watch CNBC.com for the key data of the day, PCE. Personal consumption expenditures. It's an important number.
It's the Fed's most important number. I'm glad we're covering it.
We'll be online with full coverage starting at 8:15 a.m. Morgan Brennan Steve Leisman, Rick Santelli all drew the short. No, they didn't draw the short.
We need their analysis.
Yes, we need it. We need it now more than ever. With the numbers, news, and analysis, that's at 8:15 a.m. tomorrow on CNBC.com.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, Sentencing Day is here for disgraced crypto king Sam Bankman-Fried. Puck's Teddy Schleifer joins us on the high stakes for the once high flyers jail time.
If you had, you know, a Bitcoin in November 2022, you're going to have the value of that Bitcoin today. But obviously, Bitcoin is, you know, prices have increased by 300%. So it's a question of what is the opportunity cost you lost by, you know, being a victim of a crime.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Stand by, Joe. This is Mike Q.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Joe Kernan along with Becky Quick. Andrew's off this week.
Former FTX CEO Sam Bankman-Fried is heading back to Manhattan federal court today for sentencing. He's facing up to 50 years in prison, while his lawyers have asked for no more than 6.5 years. Joining us right now is Puck's Teddy Schleifer. Teddy, Joe asked the question when you sat down. You didn't answer it yet, but it's the right one.
Yeah. Go ahead.
40 or 6?
40 or 6. You know, there are 34 numbers in between. right. Look, I mean, I think the consensus is that this is going to be somewhere between 20 to 30. And, you know, in a lot of ways, this is almost more interesting to me than the trial itself. You know, there's obviously no debate that's going to happen about the facts of what crime Sam allegedly, or I guess no longer allegedly committed. It really goes to, like, what is the point of the criminal justice system, right? Is it to make sure that someone like Sam Bankman-Fried doesn't come along again and commit, you know, some future crime over some future asset class that we don't even know about?
So that, because that worked with Madoff.
Right. or is it about, like, what is fair, right? And you know, the conception of fairness here is, you know, might remind you of, like, a college, like, philosophy seminar, but is it fairness about what Sam deserves? Is it fairness about what happens to victims?
Yeah.
Is it fairness about what it says about America or about society? These are, like, weighty questions that aren't easy to answer.
There is a narrative out there that I think has been put out by Sam Bankman-Fried's side that, hey, the money's all back, everything's here, no harm, no foul, let us go.
Yeah.
Is that true? There were victim statements that were put in last week.
So it's complicated. It kind of depends on whether or not you believe that victims should get the money they had as of November 2022, when this whole thing collapsed, or if victims should get the money that they would have today if nothing had happened.
But a lot of these people have had no access to their money, and have had,
right.
there was a woman who put in, a mother who has a disabled child who has had no access to her funds, and talked about how awful this has been for her. There's no question that Sam Bankman-Fried was using the funds as a piggy bank for himself, for his family, for everyone around him, using those funds freely without any recourse or thought to what would happen to these people whose money he was taking.
Yeah, and for someone who spent the last 15 months, you know, worrying about whether or not the money was ever going to come back, there's obviously, you know, this has been a traumatic experience, obviously, as you can tell when you read those letters. But yes, victims have been made whole, so to speak, in that there was never, you know, if you had, you know, a Bitcoin in November 2022, you're going to have the value of that Bitcoin today. Yeah. But obviously, Bitcoin is, you know, prices have increased by 300%
right. In
recent months. So, like, it's a question of, like, what, you know, what is the opportunity cost you lost by, you know, being a victim of a crime?
But it was also, look, he was clearly commingling the funds, lying about it, you know, it was there was a big charade that was put up.
And it's going to be interesting because today, you know, things, questions like that are not going to be debated.
Yeah,
right.
Argument.
I mean, whether or not Sam intentionally committed fraud or not, that's not that's and that's why I find this today more interesting than the trial, because it really relates to the bigger questions about, you know, how do we judge a person like this in society?
Yeah,
right. Is it about, you know, for instance, I know Sam was obviously not remorseful at all, really, during trial. And the judge clearly was agitated with him. But should that matter? That's actually an interesting question. Like, does Sam's attitude in court matter? That's something that, like, you know, I understand if you're the judge, you want the guy to be respectful. You don't want him to be so pedantic like he was.
Well, you want them to be remorseful so that if they get out, they don't do it again.
Right. Though, you know, Sam's team is going to argue that it's not that he's not remorseful so much as it is that he's not have the emotional IQ to.
That's
show
a fair point.
Right.
That's a fair point.
That's why it's fascinating, yeah. Because these questions aren't easy, and they're almost not really about the merits.
Because if he's on the spectrum and he's not acting the way we would think typical people should act, maybe that's not a fair charge against him.
Yeah, and you know, Sam's team is also going to argue that this is a guy who is 30 years old, and if he is sent away for 40 to 50 years in a prison, you know, his parents have said they fear for his life. And, you know, look, I mean, obviously this is an argument, and they're trying to convince someone to do something that would be nice to their kid. But they genuinely believe that, like, you know, his lack of emotional IQ and his inability to read people could put him at danger. That's why this I'm so excited for today, not because you want to, like, wash this public flogging. But I do think this is, when you think about the big picture here, about what is the role of, like, a judge, a prison, you know, you have to consider things like, is this person going to be safe? You know, should we care about his kind of mental condition, you know, over the next 40, 50 years of his life? Or is the fraud so bad, you know, that we should just be willing to punish until, you know, there's no limit to it?
Yeah, those are all good questions. If he were to get 20 to 30 years, what would that be with time off for good behavior?
What kind of good behavior we're talking about? I mean, so because Sam has spent the last, you know, he's obviously been in jail now since last August.
Yeah.
You know, we forget, and we won't forget today because he's going to show up, you know, not in a suit and tie, and he's not going to look the same as he did a couple months ago. You know, but he spent some time in prison doing some tutoring. You know, I'm sure this will be litigated for the next, you know, I'm sure it'll get appealed immediately. There's going to be a lot of twists and turns here, but. You know, 20 or 30 years, even if he gets a couple years off, like Elizabeth Holmes got.
I guess that's fair. Leopold and Loeb, one of them got killed in prison. The other one got out early for time served after killing a 14-year-old and planning it methodically.
Yeah, you know, lives can diverge.
Yeah.
You know, the Madoff and Holmes comparisons are going to be made a lot today. Yeah. You know, Madoff was sentenced to 150 years, but he was, you know, old by the point he was sentenced. You know, Sam Bankman-Fried, plausibly, if at least, you know, if he was, you know, on the streets here in New York, yeah, could live another, you know, 60 years, 70 years. So, like, these are really interesting questions about, like, what should the number be given his age, I think, is going to be an interesting question today.
Yeah.
Because this is somebody who, if you listen to Sam's side, could have a tremendously positive impact on the world.
Right.
If only we were so nice to let him walk free.
Right.
It's good questions.
Yeah. And we've seen far too often people that are out on the streets that are
repeat offenders.
Repeat offenders is a rough week. It's a week today. I mean, it's a rough week for people that are being out there. And I mean, this was not a victimless crime, obviously, but you know, other people are getting out without bail.
Right.
That have done. But in the remorse thing, there's a lot of remorseful psychopaths that really aren't.
Right, playing the jury.
It's like everybody in prison's innocent too. They're both remorseful and innocent. Right. In prison.
It'll be interesting to see
questions.
Today. Mm. It'll be interesting to see today on the point of remorse about whether or not Sam speaks.
Right.
You know, it's possible his parents speak. Like today is you know, again, not a trial on the merits of what happened. But so, you know, he obviously testified in his defense, and it kind of backfired pretty dramatically. His parents did not take the stand. It's possible that all of them speak today, not about what happened, but about whether or not this is a person who should be, you know, sent away for the rest of his life. And knowing Sam, you got to think that he's going to bet on himself again and, like, try, you know, to do his best Braveheart speech and somehow convince the people to get out of this.
This gives us a lot to think about, and I'm going to be sitting here thinking a lot about it. So thank you.
Sure thing.
Next on Squawk Pod, two professors and an economist walk into the Squawk Box set to talk TikTok.
31% say hands off my TikTok.
Our Steve Leisman with polling data from voters on the TikTok divestor ban bill. And NYU professor Josh Tucker says interpret polls with caution.
When we ask a poll and we ask people about TikTok, yes, people are going to tell us their opinions about TikTok. And they may be very upset about it. And they might be very upset about it for good reasons. But the jump from that to it actually affecting voting behavior is actually kind of a huge leap.
Plus, Yale's Joanne Lippmann on the power of the platform.
Oh my gosh, there's this outcry. All the representatives are getting spammed with all kinds of calls and all kinds of protests, but that's because TikTok set it up.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod from CNBC. TikTok is growing in importance as the primary news and information source for younger Americans. The short-form video apps Cadence and Visuals, The Scroll, it's ubiquitous in how younger citizens receive and process news. Lawmakers, educators, hey, media executives, everybody is worried about the Chinese-owned app's dominance in the lives of young Generation Z. Becky Quick takes things from here.
Steve Leisman joins us right now on set with the results from the latest edition of the All America Economic Survey. Today, Steve is taking a look at TikTok, whether it's seen as a security threat and whether Americans want it banned. Steve, what's the...
It's very interesting, Becky. It's an issue that pits national security concerns against personal tech freedoms, and a majority of Americans are concerned enough about national security support banning TikTok or forcing its sales. But hold on, because there are substantial divides along political lines, generation lines, and I guess you'd call them along tech lines. 20% say it should be banned no matter what. 27% say it should be banned unless sold to a non-Chinese company. So put that together, 57% are in support of a ban or a sale. But 31% say, hands off my TikTok. Democrats split 40-38 in favor of a ban, so they're pretty well divided within the 3.1% margin of error. Independents 34-40 against a ban. Republicans 60-20 for the ban. A large percentage you don't see there, don't know enough to say. But those splits there on the political lines are not the big splits. Take a look at these. 31% all want it banned, but 18 to 34, 48% do not want it banned. 65 and older, what is that thing, TikTok? They're saying, let it go. And when it comes to those who use TikTok the most, 53% of TikTok users say it shouldn't be banned. That includes 67% of daily users, don't touch my TikTok, and 44% of those who use it weekly or less. But 20% of the non-users say, it doesn't matter. Good, take it away. This issue may be more fraught for the Democrats and Biden than for Republicans and Trump. Biden's struggling to hold his winning coalition together and already has a problem with the youth vote, in part over the Israel-Hamas war. So our latest survey shows that the 18 to 34 group has a 33% approval rating on Biden. Their average over the course of the Biden presidency has been 40%. We had a tick up for Biden overall, and that was back to the average of 40%, but not for the youth vote. The best outcome from a political perspective could be a sale, one that's seamless to users, but this could only be the beginning of a series of issues that pit national security and social and cultural concerns against tech freedoms. Maybe young against old, tech savvy against the not so tech savvy. I'm not looking at you, Joe, for any particular reason.
My daughter asked me. Do you? You know, she's worried. Do you have TikTok on your phone? I go, you mean my clock? What are you?
Exactly. No,
I've never been on it.
No. I'm not sure who is qualified.
But I don't think we should ban it. So even though I don't know
I'm
anything
shocked.
About it,
I'm shocked that the majority of younger people said yes. Like 48% said they shouldn't. They
right, that is true.
You know what? So that means 50%.
No, hold on. Let me take a look at that for you, Becky. You are, you know,
You like you look for the wound and then you pour salt in it.
No, I
want to double check that. I'll tell you why, because I want to see.
Maybe some people didn't.
There might be a large percent of undecided.
Okay.
So let me look at that.
That would
I'm guessing
sense.
That was the plurality we put up, but, yeah. But you go ahead and have a conversation among yourselves. I'll look up the data.
Okay. Well, I mean, this brings us to a very big debate that's taking place. Steve, the other thing I'll throw out while you're looking at that is the people who say, yeah, they think it should be banned. How strongly do they feel that way versus the ones who say, no, it should not be banned? And I would guess that the people who feel more strongly about it are the ones who are using it and don't want it taken away.
No, your cleverness astounds me every day. Because what we didn't do in this thing, is what's called an intensity gauge.
Yeah.
We didn't ask how strongly you feel about this. It was a question that was hard enough to ask because we had to do the precept, the precondition, are you a TikTok user or not?
Yeah.
So it gets to be kind of cumbersome. But that's a great way to think about it, is how intense are the feelings on this?
Yeah, people who are probably angry about it if you take their TikTok away. Let's bring in two more voices on this
debate. Where are you
going
to be when I do the next poll? I'm calling you up first, okay?
Okay, deal. the voices on TikTok and the effects of a possible for sale or nationwide ban. Joanne Lippman is a lecturer at Yale University, of course, also a CNBC contributor. And Josh Tucker is co-director of NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics. He's also professor of politics at NYU and affiliated professor of data science and the director of NYU's Jordan Center for Advanced Study of Russia. Josh, what do you think? You're in tune with young people being at a university like this. What is your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, we know that TikTok is enormously popular with younger users, and there is exactly this age discrepancy that we've talked about here previously. The bigger question here is sort of like, what's the longer term ramification of this? What do we think is going to happen? Yes, younger voters are going to be upset about the fact that TikTok is banned, if it was banned. But whether or not that's likely to have any sort of implication on the election is an open question, right? And there are a couple of reasons to think that may not be the case. One is that partisanship is really what drives people's voting behavior. We already know how about 90% of people are going to vote in the 2024 election, right?
But so there's 10% very matters. They decide elections.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, so there's very little that's sort of like there's a small portion of the electorate that's up for grabs. We also know that there are a lot of different issues that young people vote that care about, right? We know they care about the economy, and we also know that youth turnout has increased in recent elections, but that youth are very much concerned as well with issues like abortion. So when we ask a poll and we ask people about TikTok, yes, people are going to tell us their opinions about TikTok. And they may be very upset about it, and they might be very upset about it for good reasons. But the jump from that to it actually affecting voting behavior is actually kind of a huge leap.
Joanne, I think your point was incredibly interesting. This idea that young people get their information for TikTok, so everything they think about this debate has been framed by TikTok.
That's exactly right. That is, it's the primary news source for Gen Z. For people who are on TikTok and Gen Z, this is where they go for their news. All the news they're getting about this legislation comes from TikTok. And not only that, TikTok has been behind this mobilization. Like we hear, oh my gosh, there's this outcry. All the representatives are getting spammed with all kinds of calls and all kinds of protests from, but that's because TikTok set it up. TikTok, if you go on TikTok, which I was just on TikTok, and the primary video is from the CEO, that's the number one video on this legislation. And it's, he's out there saying, this will be a ban. Talk to your senators. And then these young people are getting notifications on their phones from TikTok that say, here's how to contact your representative. Give us your zip code. We're going to tell you how to do it. So what's so funny is, and I don't know if it's funny, it's ironic, is that what the legislation is concerned about is one of the issues is, can TikTok manipulate voters?
Yeah.
And here's sort of a great example. I don't know whether you would want to call it motivation or manipulation in terms of how
some House members who got a huge number of these calls coming in said it actually pushed them to think, yeah, we definitely need to get rid of TikTok or at least have it in U.S. owned hands.
Right. When we think about the effect of social media on elections, we can think about this very sort of narrow question about people's opinions about the TikTok ban and how that might implement their voting decisions. Right. But then there's a much larger question of how it is that we think the entire social media environment affects the way people vote, right, and affects the voting process. So since we've had the rise of social media in this country, we've seen so much political campaigning that's moved online, and we've seen use of it by politicians. And so this remains a sort of big open question that people are trying to get answers to, which is, how does social media affect the impact of elections? So I think it's important to keep these two things distinct, right? One is like the much larger question of, the information environment and how that's affecting people's vote, how they get information about voting, where they go to search for information. I think this point about people using TikTok, essentially younger people using TikTok as the way that older people use Google, is a fascinating question. But that's separate from the first question we were discussing, which is whether anger over a proposed ban that almost undoubtedly would not go into effect before the election. And the way that this would roll out, of course, would be you wouldn't be able to get the app from the App Store, so that it would be a sort of a slow-moving period where people started to lose access. Yeah,
take it away.
I'm fascinated where we are in history right now, because there's a lot of dots you can connect with this TikTok ban. They're looking at Apple and Google in Europe now. We're talking about a ban on social media in Florida. We are in, I don't know what you call it, Joanne's so good at coming up with phrases, this ex-post tech boom regulatory period, where we're trying to put together these issues of, we've created all of this stuff, now how and do we regulate it? Substantial issues about personal freedoms that are out there, and how far, what the government's role should be. Just as surely as we're out there deciding to subsidize chip making, we're out there deciding whether and how much to regulate. I thought, Joe, your point was really interesting. Republicans generally skewing in favor of the ban, but you could make a really strong libertarian argument of, don't touch this stuff. This is not for you to do. And by the way, once we start with TikTok, would we ban any provision of user data to any Chinese company? What, aren't there Chinese financial companies that might be gathering our data?
The left and right are both fractured on so many, you know, it's so many different things you can be.
There are ways to split and skew. And,
so you got maybe the hardcore religious right that doesn't like what supposedly it's doing to our children, but then you've got the libertarian right that thinks, what, this is a private company, or, you know,
which is why nothing ever gets done in Washington, and nothing.
Well, some of those things are legitimate
concerns
from, it could be 51.
Can I just give you the data real quickly, Becky? It was 19% are either don't know or unsure.
Okay.
So the plurality, 48 is a big plurality of the youth who are opposed to the ban.
Okay, I withdraw my question.
Can I make a point on this question of the regulation? I mean, one of the things that's really distinct about TikTok is we are having this conversation about what's happening on the platform from a very speculative standpoint. We can do what Joanne is doing, which is we can go on and we can look and see what our experiences are. But the whole nature of TikTok, what's so disruptive about it, is that it doesn't deliver content through the social graph the way that other social media platforms do. It has a personalized algorithm, which means that we're all seeing different things.
Right.
We see different things. And so the type of work that we do at the NYU Center for Social Media and Politics is we try to pull back and get much more broader views by looking at wide swaths of data across these platforms. But we don't know what's going on with TikTok because TikTok hasn't made their data available for external researchers. We're kind of going into this blind. So when we think about regulation, there's all these questions we want to ask on a regulatory sense, antitrust, all the things that you're bringing up here. But the prime mover of regulation has to be regulation that allows us to get access to this data so that we can understand what's going on in this platform, so that scholars like me and my lab can inform journalists, can inform policymakers when they go to think about regulation, they know what's actually happening on this
platform. I've seen what TikTok is on TV. There's a nun, and she's using TikTok to help her student. Haven't you seen
the commercials? Yes, the TikTok commercials.
I mean, it's really nice.
Folks, all valid points.
They do other things.
I wish we had more time to dig into this. Josh, Joanne, Steve, thank you guys very much.
The father whose son was killed in a drug.
It's terrible. I mean, look, there are good uses for social media, and then there are concerning uses. But you're right. We don't know what they're being used for.
Those are the two I've seen.
I think the NYU professor is confused, thinking the politicians need actual information to make.
We can always hope.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for tuning in. The stock markets are closed tomorrow in observance of Good Friday. We will not have a new podcast for you. But data nerds, head to CNBC.com at 8:15 for special live stream coverage of the release of the Fed's favorite inflation indicator, maybe yours too, the U.S. Core Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, PCE. Data for February is due at 8:30 Friday morning. Go to our app or any browser. Visit CNBC.com for live analysis. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. And Squawk Pod, this podcast, is available wherever you listen. We'll meet you back here on Monday. Happy Easter to those who celebrate, and have a great weekend.
And we are clear. Thanks, guys.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.